Welcome to Elevate Your Energy Radio. This is Evelyn Lambrecht, your host from ElevateYourEnergy.com, where you can download your 5 days to more energy guide, which I realize I forgot to mention on the last few shows. I'm very excited about today's show with Dr. Victoria Sweet. I know I say that every single show, but I feel like today's a little different. Today we aren't talking about a certain health condition like I usually do on the show, but we're talking about healthcare. And we're talking about one of my favorite books I've ever read, Victoria's book, God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. I just read it for the fourth time this weekend, and I love reading, you might know that, but to read a novel four times is a lot, even for me. But I just love it so much, it's really hard to describe the exquisite writing and even do the book justice in this interview, but I will certainly try. And I would say if you work in healthcare in any way or are just interested in it or just want to read a beautifully written novel, I highly recommend that you get a copy. It's called God's Hotel. I've given it to many of the doctors I work with as gifts. My fiance has read it and he's an engineer. He doesn't work in this field. And whenever I read it, I can't stop talking about it for weeks. So I'm really thrilled to talk about it with the author, Victoria Sweet, today. Dr. Sweet is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and a prize-winning historian with a PhD in history. She practiced medicine for 20 years at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, where she wrote God's Hotel. Dr. Sweet, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Evelyn.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. So the first question I always love to ask my guests is, why did you decide to become a doctor?
Yes. Well, that was an interesting kind of thing for me. I'd never considered myself a natural born doctor, so I had no idea in my head about medicine at all growing up and in college. But what happened was that I actually ran into serendipitously Carl Jung's memoirs, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, so the Jungian, right, the psychiatrist. And I loved this book. I loved the way Jung had set up his life. I loved the depth to which he'd lived it. And so I decided I was going to be a Jungian analyst. And at the time, to do that, you had to have an MD. So that's how I got to medical school. But then I turned out I liked medicine way more than I thought I would. So that's kind of the short answer. So I ended up becoming what I consider a real doctor. You know, a doctor of the body rather than of the mind, although mm-hmm. it's hard to distinguish them usually.
And how did you end up at Laguna Honda? And actually, the first time I read your book, the way you described it, I was like, how long ago did this book take place? Yeah. Like, this doesn't sound like a real place.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a trip. And in fact, in your introduction, you call God's Hotel a novel, but it's actually not a novel.
Right.
Every single thing in it happened, and I have documentation in the back. It was a wild place because its traditions go all the way back to the Middle Ages. But I practiced in it. I wrote the book 5 years ago, which is when I stopped practicing there. So part of your confusion might have been that, you know, it looked like a really old-fashioned hospital. It was designed in the mission style of San Francisco, so it looked like an old 12th-century medieval monastery. The patients were on open wards, like you see in some of those old black-and-white movies from the 30s with the curtains that go around them, around the beds. And we even had a live-in priest and a resident nun. It was on 62 acres of land in the middle of San Francisco. And originally it was the San Francisco almshouse, which is how we used to take care of people before there was health insurance. So we actually had a way, and Laguna Honda was sort of the last almshouse in the country mm-hmm. when I started. So I got there kind of accidentally. I had been practicing medicine for about 10 years at least, and I loved it, but I started realizing that there was a whole level of what's really going on with patients that the medicine I learned in school and residency and all that really didn't get to. So I started looking into Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine and all that kind of stuff, And eventually I ran into a book by a medieval woman nun named Hildegard of Bingen. And she'd written a book on her medicine from the 12th century, and I was fascinated by it. So I decided I wanted to go back to school and study it and understand its relationship to the medicine I practiced. And that meant that I really needed to stop practicing full-time. I didn't want to stop practicing completely, and I looked all over. So 25 years ago now, it was very difficult to find a part-time job as a doc. And in fact, at Laguna Honda, the medical director was the only part-time job that I got, so I just took it. I told her I'd come for 2 months, and I ended up staying for 20 years because the place was fascinating.
Yeah, and what I love so much about your book, too, is, and your writing, is the way that you weave in the story of your experience as a physician there with, you know, studying the history of medicine at the same time and going on this pilgrimage. So tell us a little bit more. What fascinated me was the pre-modern medicine that you talk about, that Hildegard of Bingen studied. That was actually the beginnings of Western medicine, though everything that she described is something that we would think of now as maybe alternative medicine or integrative medicine. Can you explain a little bit, like, what you learned from her and then how you incorporated that in your practice?
Well, it was really, really fascinating because before I discovered Hildegard and pre-modern Western medicine, of course, when I was looking for what I thought of as the missing piece of the modern medicine that I practice, I'd first looked at Chinese medicine, I looked at Ayurvedic medicine, I looked at naturopathy and homeopathy, and they were all really interesting systems, but I didn't have a way to get them. And then when I discovered what Hildegard was talking about, which was the kind of medicine that we used in the West before the end of the 19th century, which wasn't very long ago, really. It's 130 years ago, not very long ago, we were practicing the medicine that Hildegard writes about. And this medicine is very much like Chinese medicine, very much like Ayurvedic medicine. And I got fascinated by the similarities because they did not, all three of those medicines grew up separately. So Western medicine, before it was the kind of medicine I practice now, which I think of as, it's medicine that's basically the one that we practice now, the bottom model is the model of body as machine. That's kind of the basic model we have today. And it's been very, very powerful. It came in the 19th century. And this is where doctors, we look at you and we try and find out when you're sick, what's wrong, what's broken, and how can we repair it or replace the broken part. That's kind of basically the model. And Hildegard's model of the body is more of a body as a plant and the doctor as a gardener. And it turns out that this was the kind of model we had in the West up until the end of the 19th century, up until about 140 years ago. This was the fundamental model. And it actually goes all the way back to Greece, to 500 BC, to Hippocrates. And this is a model that is very like the Chinese and Ayurvedic model. It's a model that's based, comes out of a rural culture, a real horticultural culture, and it sees the body as a plant affected by the seasons, where the gardener doesn't generally do things to the plant, but more steps back and looks at how it's doing. How's the plant doing? Does it need more water? Does it need less water? More sunlight? Does it need fertilizer? This idea that your goal is to optimize the body's functioning by removing what's in its way.
And I see that a lot. So I work in functional and integrative medicine, and I definitely see that in the doctors that I work with. And I want to ask you more about the slow medicine. But before we do that, would you mind sharing maybe your favorite story, either from the book or maybe one you didn't share in the book, of how you practice this slow medicine in the hospital?
Favorite story is very difficult. But I think, you know, the two stories that I both do have in the book that were probably most significant for me as sort of turning points was the story I tell about the patient I call Terry Becker in the book, mm-hmm. who was homeless. She lived on the streets. You know, she was only in her 30s. And she lived with her boyfriend, Mike, and they lived on the streets, and she begged and did God knows what, and they used drugs, and she smoked and drank. And then one day she woke up, and she was paralyzed from the neck down. And she went to the general, and they diagnosed what she had, which was, it's called a viral transverse myelitis, so didn't have really any treatment. They sent her to us. I sent her to me, and she did start to get better, and then Mike shows up and takes her out, and she's goes back and forth from onto the streets trying to get better from this transverse myelitis. Eventually, she developed a huge bed sore. It was just unbelievably big. When I saw it for the first time, I was just shocked. It went from both sides of her hips all the way down to her spine. It was so big. And she'd already had three grafts in the hospital, an acute hospital, but everyone, you know, Mike showed up and went out. And finally, the surgeons couldn't do anything more, and they had this, there was this great big hole. And when I saw it, I was just going like, you know, this thing is going to take forever to heal. What's going to happen? Carrie's going to die of this, because, you know, giving people antibiotics for something like that doesn't work to prevent infection. It was going to take years to heal. And in the meantime, what chance did she have of not getting an infection that would kill her? So that's when I had been studying Hildegard and Hildegard's concept of, you know, what in other cultures has been called the natural healing power of the body. And Hildegard called it viriditas, from the Latin viridis, that means green. So her sort of horticultural gardening method was seeing the patient as a plant, and just the same way a plant has greening power, she believed that the body had greening power, and that what we do as docs is to try and remove what's in its way. So when I was looking at Terry's big old ulcer on her back, her big old bed sore, huge, and there's nothing I could do from a medical point of view, from a fast medicine, modern medicine, body of the machine model, I thought to myself, well, what would Hildegard do? How would she look at this thing? And I thought, you know, well, maybe she just would move what's in the way of viriditas. And so I looked at Terry's bed sore, and I looked at her, and I thought, well, what's in the way? And I thought about all the medications she was taking, of course, that she didn't need. I thought about all the gunk in the middle of the graft that could be removed. I thought about supporting her viriditas with good food and sunlight and fresh air and sleep. So those are the orders I wrote. Really not doing anything except getting out of the way. And because Laguna Honda was such an unusual place, where because it was so old-fashioned and it was over the hill to the poorhouse and nobody much paid attention to us at the time, I kind of had carte blanche to keep her and do that. And so I did, and it was just amazing to watch viriditas work. It really was remarkable because that bed sore filled in gradually it over 2 years, and I watched it, you know. Mm-hmm. I watched it magically just reconstitute her body. It was remarkable. And by the end, it took 2.5 years to heal. You know, it completely healed. And of course, in the meantime, she's healed psychologically and spiritually, right? Because she had the time to do it. And that's when I started thinking about this old way of practicing as a slow medicine that used tincture of time, that got out of the way, and thought about it as something to use along with what I started calling fast medicine, which is this other way of looking at the body. And so with all my patients after Terry, I saw them try to see the problem in both perspectives. You know, I sort of I think of Western medicine, or really modern medicine, modern technological medicine with this model body's machine, as looking at the patient in a focused way, you know, looking kind of down at the patient, right, inside the patient. What's wrong? What's broken? And how can I fix it? But at the same time, also having this different model that also looks at the patient in the context of their environment and asks, you know, what's in the way of their viriditas, of their own natural healing power, and what can we do to remove what's in the way, and what can we do to support it? And what I find is that they both work really well, especially when you use them together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this concept, and I love the way you told the story just now and in the book. And I think this is slow medicine, even just from the very beginning, like spending a lot more time with your patient when they first come in. You know, I know a lot of doctors who practice that, but they're in private practice. And I'm wondering, with how healthcare has moved now, do you think that's possible to do in a hospital environment these days?
Well, not only do I think it's possible to do it, I think it's absolutely crucial to do it. That what's really gone wrong is just what I'm thinking about now, because I'm just finishing up my next book, which I'm calling Slow Medicine, Healing in an Age of Technology. And what I'm kind of really been possessed for about the past year and a half by kind of what's gone wrong with healthcare. What can we do to allow it to remove what's in its way? And this whole concentration on fragmenting the patient's care into a million pieces is completely inefficient. So there are actually, in the last couple of years since I have God's Hotels, I've been out there, I've had a tremendous opening of what's going on out there in the world, right? I've been speaking and people show me what they're doing, and there's a lot of really interesting research that shows that if we really want to save money, what we will do is give patients and doctors back their time together. When we do that, is how you save money. And when we don't do that, is how you get a costly, inefficient system. So I think that, so there's a couple of particularly good research studies that have been going on that exactly look at this. One of them was a very small one, but it was kind of interesting. So I have this idea of starting slow medicine clinics, where doctors and patients just have enough time, and then the doctor trained in modern medicine can do this wonderful history and physical and careful examination that I learned. And also has the time to try different things, to take people off all the medicines they've collected, to just practice really good medicine. I mean, we call it slow medicine, but really it's just good medicine. And what healthcare's turned into is the worst possible medicine. Just, you see one doctor and then the other doctor, and none of these records match, and people come in and out, and it's just... It couldn't be less efficient if they tried to make it that way.
It's interesting too, because there's the whole other side of the some people have other solutions than what you're proposing. I don't know if you've read Dr. Eric Topol's book, The Patient Will Save.
Yes, I have. Yeah. Absolutely.
I've been trying to get him on the show, but he's just too busy. And I know now he's doing the White House Personalized Medicine Initiative. But, it's about how patients can take charge of their own health through using their smartphones, and then using algorithms to arrive at a diagnosis without having to see a doctor at all. And so he says that healthcare is the last industry where technology and innovation hasn't happened like it has in other industries. I was wondering what you think about that view.
Well, I think that is a fine view as long as the patient is not sick. It's wonderful if you're completely well. And I have friends who do that. Most of them are computer nerds. And they have all those little machines. But the instant that they're sick, it doesn't do you much good to find out you've got a 28.2% chance of having a viral pneumonia and a 14% chance of... I mean, what are you going to do with that information? Right. Especially if you're sick. So the way I see all of that is that technology is fine in its place. And what we need to do as human beings is determine... Where's the right place for which technology? So some of the new technologies are fabulous, and I'll give you an example of one. Some of them are horrible, and some of them are just ridiculous. So I'll give you an example of one that I think is great. I don't know if you want to go in this detail, Evelyn.
Sure, yes, I love this.
Well, I found this fascinating, okay, because obviously I'm a bit of a Luddite in this sense. I'm not actually a Luddite. So... I'm just a little off, but it isn't exactly. That's a little off topic, but it actually isn't off topic because I write my books. I write everything, the first draft, with a fountain pen in notebooks.
Wow.
Yeah. I find that's how I get the best quality writing. But then my second draft, I put it in the computer and I edit the heck out of it, because computers are great for editing, right? Way better than trying to do it with a draft and a notebook, right? Computers are great for that. So then I edit and edit and edit and edit a lot. And then when I think it's all perfect and really great, then I print it out like it was a book. Because when I look at that third way we have of writing, of conveying ideas, I see it even differently. And I can see things that I don't like that are wrong then that I can't see when I write it with my fountain pen, and I can't see it on the computer. And that's kind of a way in my own life where these three different technologies for writing, I use all three of them in their place.
Mm-hmm.
In medicine, so I'm not really a light, but I like, to me, it's like what works best. It's not always the technology that works best. So a technology that's fantastic and would fit into just where Topol is talking about is this cool technology for turning your phone into an otoscope.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, he talks about it in the book. I think I've seen a video he did on it.
Oh, well, you know, it was just, the short story is a couple of years ago, teaching the medical students, and they show up with, the ENT guys are experimenting with this, and they show up with it, and I just thought it was brilliant. It was way better than an otoscope at every level. Okay, it was simpler to use. You could easily see how, you know, a mother at home, even if she couldn't figure it out for herself, I mean, she could do it, right? And if it was confusing what she saw, she could, like, email it to somebody. Very simple, very straightforward, for the most, you know, a very common reason to show up in the ER with your four-year-old, which is an ear infection, or not. So I thought this was a technology that was a great improvement on what we've had before. I think electronic health records are a fabulous example of a complete disastrous technology, but that isn't disastrous in and of itself, right? The idea behind electronic health records seems is a great idea, but the way it's actually played out has been a disaster. I mean, literally a disaster at every level. It doesn't do anything what it could do. Every, you know, interoperable, you know, if you have a CT scan at one hospital, they can read it at another. Doctors can find out what the other doctor. It doesn't do any of that. And it blows the story of the patient into little tiny pieces of data,
mm-hmm.
which is useful for big data, doubtless, and is useful for marketing and useful for pharmacology, for pharmacies and all this kind of stuff. But it is antithetical to actually figuring out what's wrong with the patient. So that, to me, is an example of a technology that should be good but is terrible. And an example of a technology that's just in and of itself horrible, I would say, is Google Glass. This idea that your doctor is your healthcare provider, I'm not going to call them doctors at this point, is going to walk into you looking at a computer, looking at a miniature computer in the corner of his eye. It's just nonsense. It's terrible. There is no way that could be anything but harmful, as far as I'm concerned. So I think what we need to do is make it clear that we're going to figure out which is great, which is terrible but could work, and which is innately horrible. And the problem with, I won't say Topol, but I will say with many of the other doctors who are on myriads of boards of startup companies, who have a lot to gain by beating the personalized medicine drum, I'm extremely skeptical, because I think there's too much personal gain going on in medicine to make us be able to make those really clear distinctions in technology.
It's really interesting, because I love the science behind it. I work for a nutritional supplement company, which I love. So I interact with doctors chiropractors, you know, NDs, MDs, DOs every day. I absolutely love it. And, you know, we do look at lab tests. We look at microbiome. We look at genetic testing. And I love all of that. And I'm not a doctor. I'm not a nurse. You know, I'm not a healthcare administrator. But I also feel so passionate about preserving the personal aspect of the personalized medicine. And I think that's why I love integrative and functional medicine so much, because really at the heart of that is the patient-practitioner relationship. And in your book, you talk about how that's really like the secret to healing. I was wondering if you just want to share a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I actually think that's something that almost everybody knows. You know, we all know it. And that's actually what kind of, there's that sort of murmurous uproar that's kind of in the background all the time of people just being completely frustrated. You know, my doctor never looks at me anymore. Mm-hmm. I hear that all the time, every time I speak. And if you look at the opposite of that, which has been this rise of concierge practice, what concierge practice does is capture that. And what's, you know what, right, you have concierge practice down there, you know what
yes,
I mean by it?
Yeah.
Right. So it's where the doctors are saying, you know what, we can't take care of 2,500 patients. That's what a primary care doctor is supposed to have and take care of. Give me a break. That's ridiculous, right? So these docs are going, you know what, I can take care of 300 patients really well. And they do the math and they figure out what they need from to charge for that, and they do. And what's interesting is to look at the data about how much it really costs when you do that. Because what turns out is those patients who... So they're an example, Evelyn, this is what I'm sort of getting to. They're an example of the patient-doctor relationship, right? Because in those cases, the doctor has and patient have as much time as they want together. That's how that concierge model is set up. And when you look at the results, what you find is they have 15% fewer hospitalizations and 40% fewer ER visits. Not to speak of fewer lab tests, fewer medications, fewer everything. Mm-hmm. So even as just money-wise, it's cheaper to give when that happens. And what is really going on there? Why is that the case? Well, it's kind of magic. But the fact is that there's some kind of magic that just goes on when somebody listens to you, opens themselves up to you. You have that kind of time together. I mean, what I found is the longer I practiced medicine, the less I did. You know, I just kind of hung out. And within that space of hanging out, everything kind of settled down. Now, I'm not talking when somebody comes in the ER and needs to be sewn up. You know, so there's this distinction again. It's just like we've just headed in kind of completely, not completely the wrong direction. So you bring up stuff like the microbiome. Like this, I think, is so thrilling. Mm-hmm. That's the first new idea that's come out in my entire, you know, decades of medical practice, really. And I love it. I love it because it's completely counter everything that we've been banging the drums for about the last 100 years. Like, right? So we discovered germs, and germs are the enemy. And for 100 years, they've been the enemy. And suddenly we go like, oh my God, we're practically nothing but germs. The germs are our friends if you've got the right friends. Who are the friendly germs? Who are the germs we need? I just think it's totally cool. So I'm not a Luddite. I'm not against the scientific process at all, but I'm completely in favor of the scientific process, which is you investigate, you have hypotheses, you test your hypotheses, then you take a sample group of patients and you try one and you try the other and you see which is best. I mean, you have the people who drink personalized medicine, they're not doing that. That I can see. They're not saying, okay, we will have a whole ward at the hospital be all for personalized medicine. We'll take this group of patients and we'll give them all these gadgets. Before we go selling them and making billions and billions of dollars all across the country and advertising and having startups and, you know, getting venture fund capital. Why don't we just do an experiment? Because if there was an experiment, Evelyn, that proved that patients could do what Topol's talking about when they're sick, and it was useful, I'd say great. But I haven't seen anything like that.
Yeah. Do you think that it is possible to do what you're envisioning, but with insurance companies, HMOs, and
yes,
under Obamacare?
Absolutely. I absolutely do. In fact, so there's a small group that called the Institute of Slow Medicine that set itself up partly of UCSF in Berkeley. And because my sense is that insurance companies should be beating the door down. Because what I'm talking about is they want to save money, or really they want to make money, right? They can make more money by doing things this way than they can by doing things another way. And I think we can prove it. And there's already quite a bit of research out there that shows it's the case. So I think there's a few ways to set it out. I'm surprised that insurance companies haven't already bought into a concierge kind of model, mm-hmm, as a way to save money, right? Because I can give you, so there's just a lot of examples, but there's a really fascinating study that's due out next year out of University of Chicago, where this researcher, very cool man named David Meltzer, he's an MD, PhD at University of Chicago. About 5 years ago, he had the same insight that, boy, if doctors and patients have enough time, I bet you we save money. He got a big grant from Medicare. And he took patients coming into the emergency room and divided them, every other patient, into two groups. And one he gave usual care to. And the other one, what he did was something very fascinating. He assigned the patient when they came into hospital to a hospitalist group that when the patient was discharged would not just go back to wherever they'd come from, but would belong then to those doctors, those primary care doctors. And if the patient turned up in the ER again, those doctors, that doctor would take care of them. Mm-hmm. And if that patient needed to be admitted, that doctor would take care of them. So he put continuity of care back in the system, and he also, it was very interesting, in the clinic that belongs to that group of docs, he put money into having a really good RN and a really good social worker. And his results have been fantastic, saving tons of money because people stopped getting rehospitalized or going to the emergency room. So I'm surprised that, and his actual data, it won't be out till next year, but I'm surprised already that the insurance companies aren't doing some of these ideas if what they really want to do is save money. But there are actually a lot of experiments, some of them I don't even know about, going on across the country that have these kinds of thoughts going on.
Yeah,
and they're saving money.
And on your website, you have a tab about the Second Opinion Clinic. Is that something you are doing currently with the new Laguna Honda?
No, although I still want to do that. So the new Laguna Honda is just turning out pretty much as I expected. I would still love to do that there, but it's kind of off in its political, what to call it, whatever, it's politics. But there's a lot of, I have a number of meetings actually this week with different people to start something more like a concierge practice for the sick poor. Mm. Because it's really the sick poor that need this kind of care, and it's really the sick poor who end up spending a whole bunch of money because they go to this ER and that ER and hither and yon, and right? And so my hypothesis is if we started a practice like that for the sick poor, we would find that we would save just gobs of money. And then what I would expect is the insurance companies would turn around and say, well, let's us do that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm doing next, is looking at how can we actually put some of these things into practice. But as I said, there turns out there's a lot of people doing a lot of interesting things. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I would love to connect you with some of them as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah, a friend of mine has a friend who's an NP who works at an integrative / functional medicine clinic for the underserved in Oakland and Berkeley. And they have like four or five clinics in the Bay Area.
So, really?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good. Send me that. That's great.
Yeah. I wanted to switch back to the book for just a second. You also embarked on a pilgrimage through France and Spain while you were at Laguna Honda. You did it in four annual parts. I just wanted to know from you, what do you feel like you got out of that has served you, not just in medicine, but just in your life?
It was an amazing experience. So some of your listeners would know it, you know, because there was that book, that film about it called The Way. No, it wasn't a very good film, I'm sorry to say, but it did have very pretty pictures. So it's the classic pilgrim walk to Santiago de Compostela in Spain, and it's been done since the Middle Ages, since about 880 A.D., because the bones of Saint-Jacques showed up at in the corner of Spain, a pilgrimage route started, and when I heard that it was possible to still do it, though these many years, I just decided that once I finished my PhD, I would do it. And as you say, I set it up in four parts and did them as a pilgrim. And it was really being a pilgrim. It was sort of a classic idea from the Middle Ages that we are all pilgrims, actually. Pilgrims on the pilgrimage of life. And the idea of a pilgrim is that you leave your home, you travel with as little as possible, you rely on the kindness of strangers to get to where you're going, you walk it if you can, and you just assume that whatever happens on your way is I won't say what's supposed to happen, but that it has meaning. And that is a very interesting worldview to take. So if I had to think of one thing that's stayed with me since then, it's that feeling that things happen, it's meaningful when things happen. And that if you look at things that way, it makes life really quite interesting and quite rich. So I think that would be it. And I'm not so much talking about, you know, if you get some terrible illness that you should find the good in it and all that stuff. I'm not talking about anything that grandiose, but just in my regular day when something shows up, to kind of realize that it's almost, I'll call it a message. But it's not really a message from somebody necessarily outside yourself. I think I'll just stop there.
I know what you mean. I gotcha. I think that we can actually finish the show on that note. That was beautiful. I would like to know when can we expect your next book to be out?
Yes. Well, I'm just sitting in the lab and just going. So I'm not quite sure, but it's just about done, and I don't know when they'll put it on the schedule, but I would expect it would be, I'd like it to be next winter, I would think, for sure.
Wonderful.
So winter of, not this coming fall, yeah. So these,
fall 2017. Yeah, fall two,
fall 2017, yeah, yeah, or winter of 2018 max would be what I would hope, and I hope my editor's listening.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for anyone listening.
Thank you, Evelyn, and send me the nurse practitioner thing. That'll be very interesting. I'd love to go over and visit and meet the person and see if she's got data to show, you know, does she have fewer hospitalizations, fewer meds, that kind of stuff. Because that I think is the, what do we spend money on? That's what we spend money on in medicine.
And I'd also to connect you with the people at the functional medicine clinic at the Cleveland Clinic, because they actually have a separate branch there, and they're doing some of that research, looking at, you know, how that model works in that kind of system. And then there's also an amazing mentor of mine, Dr. Tarone Lodog. She actually has the first interprofessional fellowship in integrative medicine. So she's really all about pulling in, you know, like not just having the doctor there, but the social worker and nurse practitioner.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So. No question. Yeah. That'd be great. Send me that.
Awesome.
And thank you very much, Evelyn. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and that you are inspired to read her book, God's Hotel. Like I said, it's just really beautifully written and such a touching story. And if it wasn't, I wouldn't have read it four times. To read more about Dr. Sweet, you can go to victoriasweet.com. Make sure you check out her book, read more about it there. And next week on the show, I will be interviewing Dr. David Brady about his book, The Fibrofix, which is about getting to the root cause of fibromyalgia. Also, Dr. Sweet has a great TED Talk called The Efficiency of Inefficiency. So make sure you check that out. Thank you so much for listening. Let me know what you thought of the show. I hope you enjoyed it. I know it was a little different than the usual format. You can let me know on my Facebook page, Elevate Your Energy. Thank you so much.